This morning we are reading from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjalila, chapter 6, and we'll be doing four verses actually. We'll be doing from verse 227 to up to 230. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was pleased to see this. He became ecstatic in love of Godhead and embraced Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. The Lord and the servant embraced each other and began to dance. Simply by touching each other, they became ecstatic. Verse 229. As they danced and embraced, spiritual symptoms manifested in their bodies. They perspired, trembled and shed tears, and the Lord began to speak in his ecstasy. So I'll do the remaining verse in the second part of this class. So obviously we need a bit of context here for those who may have not witnessed the previous classes. So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has essentially converted the great learned impersonalist Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and he had defeated him with his great wisdom and of course his great mercy. The Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was a very, very educated person, and of course was known as a great, great scholar. However, there was something missing, of course, in the eyes of the Aurai tradition, which there was no real bhakti. There can be no real bhakti or no real relationships in the impersonal philosophy, where the absolute truth is a sense of oneness, a sense of the Brahma Jyoti, which I'll get into later, where there is no form or personality or no one to love, really. So how can that actually have any bhakti? How can that give anyone true satisfaction? So anyway, of course, after Sarvabhauma was admitted defeat by the reasoning of Lord Chaitanya, who was able to basically, pick flaws in Sarvabhauma's poems and his purports to the Vedas. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu exposed himself, of course, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead right in front of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya by showing his Vishnu form, four-armed Vishnu form, and then also showing his form as Lord Krishna with two arms. And at that moment, all truths were revealed to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who by that time had become most humble. In other words, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he wasn't a bad personality at all, but he had just taken this certain path, the impersonal philosophy, which actually was very, very prominent in India at that time, due to the influence of Shankaracharya from several centuries earlier. But it's very, very prominent. All the greatest scholars in India at that time were of that type. So we cannot underestimate the significance of Mahaprabhu's theological contribution, in terms of India's history. Anyway, of course, suffice it to say, Sarvabhauma became greatly purified and became a wonderful devotee. He saw Lord Chaitanya, he would lay the carpet in front of him, and he would dutifully, with great gratitude, actually, with the right attitude, with great humility, accept a little bit of Mahaprasad from Lord Jagannath, Lord of the Universe. And along with Lord Chaitanya's, Mahaprabhu's embrace of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, this word basically was, obviously, again, Lord Chaitanya's mercy upon this personality. And after smelling the tulsi leaves as well, of course, as the Kumaras did, he basically became a great, great personalist, a great, great devotee. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself later said, "He who takes shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead receives his causeless mercy and can pass beyond this ocean of nescience." Now that line from Mahaprabhu, which actually comes later in this chapter, is very significant because there's different meanings to it. If you unpack it, what does it mean? He's just said to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, only those who receive the mercy of the Supreme Lord become free from the ocean of nescience. So what does that mean? What it means is the fact that those who are on the personal path are not freed from the ocean of nescience by logic. Well, they are not completely free. In fact, what they would do is, as maximum they can achieve, is enter the Brahma Jyoti, which is something I shall describe when we get to verse 230 a bit later on. But here, I think these particular verses describe the basically ecstatic symptoms, if you read 229 again. As they danced and embraced, spiritual symptoms manifested in their bodies. They perspired, trembled, and shed tears, and the Lord spoke in ecstasy. So in other words, our material bodies, our bodies, are designed essentially to live on this earth, to interact with this earth around us. It's basically a result of our conditioned state. And our very existence and life on the earth is a result of our karma. So when one for example, someone is experiencing spiritual ecstasy, you know, as you can imagine, very unusual symptoms would happen, things which of an unusual or a special or transcendental nature, unusual things perhaps where beyond the laws of physics or beyond the laws of social understanding and expectation, because this is something that's coming from above. It's coming from something beyond the our bodies, quite literally, beyond the laws of nature, quite literally. So on that note, I wanted to share with you this morning some of the information, of course, we find from Srila Prabhupada's book, of course, The Nectar of Devotion, which is a summary of Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where there's a whole section, as many of you may already know, on symptoms of ecstatic love of Krishna. So I thought it would be appropriate to share some of that with you this morning. So the bodily symptoms manifest by a devotee in expressing ecstatic love of Krishna are called anubhav. Practical examples of anubhav are as follows. So let's kind of just, I won't do all of them, I don't think, but I will certainly touch on it. Dancing. This, of course, is something very prevalent in Chaitanya Leela. Dancing. Now, there are different examples of dancing in Krishna Leela. For example, while watching the rasa dance performed by Lord Krishna and the gopis, Lord Shiva himself beheld the beautiful face of Krishna and immediately began to dance and beat upon his small drum. While Lord Shiva was dancing in his ecstasy, his eldest son Ganesh joined him. So it's not just in Chaitanya Leela we find this dancing in ecstasy, but it's throughout other leelas. Rolling on the ground. This is something, again, which occurs in Chaitanya Leela, actually. Lord Nityananda being a good example. Now, in the third canto of Bhagavatam, Vidura inquires from Uddhava, "My dear friend, is Akrura in an auspicious condition? Not only is he a learned scholar and sinless, but he's also a devotee of Krishna. He has such ecstatic love of Krishna that I have seen him rolling upon Krishna's footprints in the dust, as if bereft of all sense." So, of course, these are all from Krishna Leela, including the Mahabharata. Then, of course, another symptom of love of Krishna is singing loudly. Of course, those who, if you go to most ISKCON temples, you'll experience a lot of singing loudly, but this is something on another level. So this is some singing loudly example. One gopi informed Krishna that when Srimati Radharani was singing about his glories, she enchanted all her friends in such a way that they became stone-like and dull. At the same time, the nearby stones began to melt away in ecstatic love. When Narad Muni was chanting Hare Krishna, he chanted so loudly, it was apprehended by that Lord Nrisingadeva appeared. Thus all the demons began to flee in different directions. That's really interesting, because the idea of when we chant Hare Krishna, all our anartas, all our conditioning is also unwelcome. We're sending it away in different directions. It takes time, and it takes a lot of pure chanting, but this is the process. And this is why chanting Hare Krishna is so important to us. Stretching the body, another symptom of ecstatic love. It is said that sometimes Narad, the carrier of the Veena, remembered Lord Krishna in great ecstasy. He begins to stretch his body so vigorously that his sacred thread gives away. Well, so imagine, of course, the Brahman thread around his torso, around his body there, was actually just gets broken because his body is stretched beyond the size of the thread. crying loudly. A gopi once said to Krishna, "My dear son of Nanda Maharaj, by the sound of your flute, Srimati Radharani has become full of lamentation and fear, and thus, with a faltering voice, she's crying like a bird. It is described that by hearing the vibration of Krishna's flute, Lord Shiva becomes puzzled and begins to cry so loudly into space that the demons become vanquished and the devotees become overwhelmed with joy." So, crying out of joy, of course not crying out of anything miserable, but crying out of joy is something which something that they again experienced in many leaders. Yawning. It is said that when the full moon rises, the lotus petals become expanded. Similarly, when Krishna used to appear before Radharani, her face, which is compared to a lotus flower, would expand by her yawning. Breathing heavily is another one. As far as breathing heavily is concerned, it is stated the Lita is just like a chakchaki bird, which only takes water falling directly from the rain cloud and not from any other source. In this statement, Krishna is compared to the dark cloud and Lalita is compared to the chakchaki bird, seeking only Krishna's company. The metaphor continues to say, as a heavy wind sometimes disperses a mighty cloud, so the heavy breath of Lalita's nostrils caused her to miss Krishna, who had disappeared by the time she recovered herself. Neglecting the presence of others. The wives of the Brahmanas were performing sacrifices at Vrindavan. They left home as soon as they heard that Krishna was nearby. They left their homes without caring for their husbands. The husbands began to discuss this amongst themselves. How wonderful is the attraction for Krishna that it has made these women leave us. This is the influence of Krishna. Anyone who becomes attracted to Krishna can be relieved from the bondage of birth and death. So he is the all-attractive one. That's a meaning of Krishna. And any other attraction of a material nature becomes insignificant. Krishna is the most beautiful, the most attractive, the most intelligent. And everybody, especially elevated people, will be attracted to nothing else as much as Krishna. Drooling. As an example of running down of saliva from the mouth, it is stated that sometimes when Narad Muni was chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, he remained stunned for a while and saliva oozed from his mouth. Here's a few more things which perhaps are less socially acceptable, let's say, in modern society. Laughing like a madman. When a devotee laughs very loudly like a madman, it is done out of an extraordinary agitation of ecstatic love within the heart. Such mad laughing is an expression of the condition of the heart, which is technically. When a devotee becomes affected with this mental condition, his love is expressed through the lips. The laughing sounds coming one after the other are compared with flowers falling from the creeper of devotion, which grows within the heart of the devotee. I hope you're enjoying these descriptions. They're really beautiful. Wheeling of the head. Wheeling of the head. I think this is lesser known, actually. One gopi told her friend, "It appears that Lord Krishna, the enemy of the demon Aga, had released from his mouth a whirlwind which is acting on your head and is gradually proceeding to do the same to the other lotus-eyed gopis." And in this particular section is belching. Sometimes belching also becomes a symptom of ecstatic love for Krishna. There's evidence of this in Purnamasi's address to one crying associate of Radharani. She says, "My dear daughter, don't be worried because Srimati Radharani is belching. I am about to offer a remedial measure for this symptom. Do not cry so loudly. This belching is not due to indigestion. It is a sign of ecstatic love of Krishna." So that's amazing, really. Quite lovely. And also in chapter 8 of the Nectar of Devotion, it goes on to explain existential ecstatic love as well. I'll use a couple of examples of those because I think they're kind of more or less in the same subject. becoming stunned. The symptom of being stunned is caused by ecstatic tribulation, fearfulness, astonishment, and lamentation. This symptom is exhibited by a stoppage of talking, a stoppage of movement, a feeling of voidness, an extreme feeling of separation of the Lord. Perspiring. So an example we can find of that in the Bhagavatam. One gopi addressed Radharani, "My dear Radharani, you are rebuking the sunshine unnecessarily, but I can understand that you are perspiring only because you are becoming too lusty at seeing Krishna." Standing hairs on the body. This can be manifested when Mother Yashoda was found within Krishna's mouth, all of the universal planetary systems. She asked Krishna to open his mouth wide just to see whether he had eaten dirt. But when Krishna opened his mouth, she saw not only the entire earth, but also many planets within his mouth. This caused the standing of hair on her body. It's also the faltering of a voice. When Krishna was going to Mathura on the chariot driven by Akura, Yashoda and all the gopis came to try to forbid him to pass and to block his way. At that time, Radharani was so perturbed that in a faltering voice, she requested Mother Yashoda to please stop Akura. So she was so, you know, obviously so distraught, as you probably can imagine, actually, for Krishna leaving Vrindavan, that she could hardly speak. Trembling is another one. When Krishna was trying to capture the demon Shankar, Radharani began trembling out of fearfulness. Similar trembling of the body was exhibited by Sahadev, the younger brother of Nakula. When Shishupal was vehemently blaspheming the Lord, Sahadev began to tremble out of anger. But ultimately, these things are all to do with the... these are not mundane trembling, this is all to do with love of Krishna, or attachment to Lord Krishna. There's even the changing of bodily colour. Sometimes, out of great grievance caused by the dealings of Krishna, the body changes colour. The gopis therefore address the Lord, "Dear Krishna, due to separation from you, all the denizens of Vrindavan have changed their colour. And because of this change of colour, even the great sage Narad was thinking of Vrindavan as a white island in the ocean of milk." So quite extraordinary here. There's also, I don't think I'll do all of them, but I do, actually let me do two more, because I'm enjoying it. Devastation. When a person is confused by simultaneous happiness and tribulation and does not know what to do, this state of confusion is called palaya, or devastation. In this condition of palaya, one sometimes falls down on the ground and all the symptoms of ecstatic love become manifest. So obviously, although devastation appears to us to be a negative word on the material platform, actually in this context, all the our symptoms of ecstatic love of Krishna are manifest within this trait. So I mean that's quite extraordinary. It's actually one of the highest realizations. Out of the many ecstatic symptoms of the body, the symptom of being stunned is especially significant. According to the degree of being stunned, the vital force within the body becomes agitated, and due to such a state, the other ecstatic loving symptoms sometimes become altered. These transient ecstatic symptoms gradually develop, and in the course of such development, they have sometimes been smoky, sometimes blazing, and sometimes been shiny. These three degrees are experienced for many, many years, and they extend to different parts of the body. And like the shedding of tears and the faltering of the voice, the condition of being stunned is spread all over the body. The shedding of tears and faltering of the voice are simply localized symptoms. So, there you go. So, in other words, sometimes it's just one aspect of the body, other times it's the entire body. But I'll share those with you. I think they're quite delightful. Now we're going to move on back to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 6. And now what we're going to do, we're going to move on to the verse 230. Aji Muni Anayashe Tinunutibhuvan, Ajimuni Karino Vaikuntha Arohan. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "Today I have conquered the three worlds very easily. Today I have ascended to the spiritual world." So Srila Prabhupada writes purport here. The goal of human perfection is stated here in brief. One has to surpass all the planetary systems of the material universe, pierce through the covering of the universe, and reach the spiritual world known as Vaikuntha Loka. The Vaikuntha Lokas are variegated spiritual planets situated in the Lord's impersonal bodily effulgence, known as the Brahma Jyoti. One may aspire to elevate himself to a heavenly planet within the material world, such as the moon, the sun, or Venus. But if one is spiritually advanced in Krishna consciousness, he does not wish to remain within the material universe, even in a higher planetary system. Rather, he prefers to penetrate the covering of the universe and attain the spiritual world. He can then be situated in one of the Vaikuntha planets there. However, the devotees, under the guidance of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, aspire to reach the topmost spiritual planet, known as Goloka Vrindavan, the residence of Lord Sri Krishna and his eternal associates. This is the special mercy of Mahaprabhu. He can give us access to not just the spiritual world, but a specific planet, a specific realm in the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan, from which, although the Vaikuntha planets are all eternal, they still within this energy, within this energy, which is the source of that, is actually coming from Goloka Vrindavan, where the realization of Lord Krishna is higher than in Vaikuntha itself. In Vaikuntha, the relationship with Krishna is more based on awe and reverence of Godhead. In Goloka Vrindavan, as we know, this is more based on intimate, loving, devotional service, as exemplified actually by the gopis, rather, of course, Radharani's love of Krishna. That is the highest. So even within Goloka Vrindavan, there's gradation, you see. And there's even different levels of gopis, even different gradations of gopis, those that also different characteristics of gopis as well. Those that are shy, those that are very bold, those that like to rebuke Krishna, those that wouldn't dare to rebuke Krishna, those with faltering voices, so on and so forth. So none of these rasas, of course, can be experienced in the Brahma Jyoti, as we were learning a bit about the Brahma Jyoti, which is the destination and the focus of impersonal. The Brahma Jyoti, just basically being a light, an energy, without form and variegatedness, emanating actually from Goloka Vrindavan, and is not present in the Vaikuntha planets, but is certainly present throughout the spiritual sky. Vaikuntha planets, of course, are there as well, and they are also the destination of personalists, but not necessarily, they don't contain Lord Krishna in his two-arm form, or as a child, or a baby, or as a youth, or even as an adult. Rather, it is the Vishnu, the Narayan forms, or the form of other Vishnu avatars, like Lord Ram or Lord Shingadev. They're all coming from Vaikuntha. But again, the lotus plant, sometimes we see images of the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where there's a big picture of a lotus plant, and then emanating from that is the Brahma Jyoti. So within that hall of that lotus plant is Goloka Vrindavan. The Brahma Jyoti itself is still beyond, in many ways, is still beyond this material world. Those that follow the impersonal path, in many ways, may be spiritually sincere in their own respect. It's just that the path and the destination, and the path is more difficult to enter the spiritual world in that route. And also, of course, if one enters the Brahma Jyoti, then there's always that chance that one will again become attracted to form and variegatedness and again fall down into the material world. So actually, when you think about it, when you compare that with what Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can offer, enter into Goloka Vrindavan or of course any of the Vaikuntha planets, once one returns there, one does not need to go, or one has no desire to return back to the material world. The material world, in fact, very interesting actually, Prabhupada spoke a few words of course about the nature of this material universe, this material cosmos. I'll just restate that again. He does not wish, those who are spiritually advanced in Krishna consciousness, do not wish to remain within this material universe. Not even in the higher planetary systems. Not even on the sun or the moon or Venus, he mentions. Of course, in the Vedic cosmology, the moon, Venus and the sun are in fact inhabited by demigods. In fact, all planets, or actually, let's say most planets, many, many planets in this material world are actually inhabited. But they don't have bodies like us, but their bodies are more subtle than ours. There is different, let's say, combinations of elements. For example, a good example would be life on the sun. We could say, how do you live on the sun? It's the fire, it's too hot. But we're talking about a demigod realm. Due to the presence of the soul, which of course is indestructible, cannot be burnt by fire or withered by the wind or whatever, or destroyed by a sword, the soul is imperishable, ever existent and primeval. And the soul, therefore, can go anywhere in the universe. It doesn't die. Of course, not like our feeble bodies. However, because of that factor, one can inhabit more subtle bodies on these planets of the sun and moon and Venus and so forth. But obviously the combination of elements would be different. With demigods, of course, having subtle bodies, there's a much greater degree of mind, intelligence and ego as their bodies. Whereas, for example, our bodies is mainly, of course, water and earth and fire and air. Like that. So that way, the universe is populated on many, many different levels. However, even though there are gradations, gopis are gradations of planets in the spiritual world, there are certainly gradations of planets in the material world. Of course, as Prabhupada is describing here, there's heavenly planets, which, Prabhupada actually says, one does not want to remain in the material, devotees do not want to remain here, not even in the higher planetary system. What that means is that there are some yogis and some people who perhaps are attracted to more of the Karmakanda section of the Vedas that may not seek liberation from birth and death, but may be aspiring for to enter a heavenly planet or a much better condition of life. In a higher standard of living. You can imagine that even on the earth, there are different gradations and different standards of living. Those who are very wealthy, perhaps, and have health and have a nice house and all these things. And those that are very poor and are suffering more materially. So we have to imagine the universe is like that, but on a much, much larger scale. Well, much larger, in fact, incredibly larger scale. But what is the problem? What is wrong with entering the heavenly planets is quite simply, from a devotee's point of view, that they are temporal. Devotees or advanced devotees are only interested in Krishna. What is it about Krishna? Obviously, he's the origin of all. He belongs in Goloka Vrindavan, although he is also everywhere simultaneously. But he is eternal. All features and aspects of the spiritual world can be characterized by something which is beyond our understanding, certainly beyond our understanding and experience of the laws of physics. Something which is simply does not end. It has no beginning, middle, or end. It just is. That yet, although these different Krishna leaders can take place, so therefore that denotes the sense of beginning, middle, and end, as we would experience. But yet there is no end. And that bliss gets more and more blissful as well. So there's no end of bliss and there's no end of time. There is no time. Well, time as we experience is colour, time, material time, time that ends, a cyclic time, actually. But that is not a feature of the spiritual world. That is only a feature of the material world. Simply when Mahavishnu lies in this ocean of nescience, the causal ocean, and starts breathing, he's obviously, at that time, the universe is, as he breathes out, the universe has come out. The pores of his skin exist for some time, and then the Mahavishnu breathes those universes back into the pores of his skin again, and that's the end of that particular set of universes. So at that point, I suppose you could argue that is the biggest, and indeed the original measurement of time. It's different measurements of time. That's the 311,040,000,000,000 years is the length of time that this Lord Brahma will last, this universe will last. But actually, in reality, from Mahavishnu's perspective, it is just one breath. That's it. It's all over. So to actually have that conception, to actually have that understanding, would mean you're pretty elevated to actually understand. Because this 311,040,000,000,000 years is only experienced as experienced on the earth. So 311 trillion of years by earthly calculation according to our experience of time. So you can imagine from the point of view of Mahavishnu how insignificant we are mentioning. Even on the heavenly planets within this material world, they experience time differently. Not as much, of course, the time difference isn't as much as between us and Mahavishnu. But in the case of Lord Brahma, for him, a day for him would be, 100 years for him would be 311 trillion years for us. In other words, 4.32 billion years on the Earth, that's practically the whole of the Earth's history, since it was, they say, it was a primordial soup. That's just a day of Lord Brahma. Half a day, in fact, so far. Lord Brahma then. So you can imagine on planets which are also heavenly, but not as high as Lord Brahma's planet, such a world. 6 months go by on the Earth when one day simultaneously goes by on the Moon. So it just seemed that the more highly elevated in those gradations, the different realms are in the universe and beyond, then the sense of time also changes. Because time, in one sense, you could describe it as a various, almost like an abstract concept. It's something that we experience, but we only experience through our bodies. If we are free of these bodies and we enter into the spiritual world, if we go beyond the cycle of birth and death, and our consciousness goes beyond that, then time becomes irrelevant. Time is no longer a factor. Not even the breathing of Mahavishnu, which is simply there simply to facilitate conditioned soul. That is the function of this material world. Krishna didn't force us here. And he doesn't force us to stay here. But we're actually here by our own choice. And that's quite controversial and even difficult to understand in some respects, because people say, why Krishna, did you make this material world? Why Vishnu, do you breathe it in and out? Why am I here? But actually, it is all by our own independence and our own choice. Krishna wants us to return to him. He wants us to return, but we can only do that independently. One thing he does not choose to have power over is our own choice, our own independence. Because if you do that, then the element of love is removed. Because love has to be voluntary. That's a characteristic of love. In terms of the gradations, as I've been mentioning, of planets or planetary systems in the material world, there are 14 altogether. There are, of course, of the Earth, which is roughly in the center, but then you've got seven lokas, seven levels above and seven levels below. Now, the first thing is we have to understand loca. What is the definition of loca? If I come for locas, it's not necessary. It doesn't translate as planet, actually. Although you have the expressions like vir loca, about virgola, or vir loca, referring to the earth level. But it doesn't necessarily translate directly as planet. It's more like a gradation, a level. Because the Vaikuntha local or Glokanda local, it's like a level of consciousness. Let's put it like that. That's the, depending on the level of consciousness that you're in, then there's a planet appropriate to accommodate your level of consciousness and indeed your karma. But however, within those lokas, if you like, those planetary systems, there are many, many different planets. But they can be categorized, let's say within, let's say one of those 14 planetary systems, 14 planetary categories or divisions. Recently I've been a part of discussions, organized by the Backgrounds Institute of Higher Studies, the BIHS, which is, although based in Gainesville, Florida, is naturally, especially in this day and age with Zoom and so forth, is international. There's quite a lot of members, of course, in India, UK, United States, and Australia, where we get together on Zoom. We talk about Bhagavatam cosmology or Puranic cosmology, actually, and also other works of Jyotish Shastras, Suyasiddhanta, and anything which, of course, is to do with astronomy. Not so much astrology, which of course is that you're the zodiacs and predicting the future of things, but astronomy, which is the nature of the universe, and even cosmography, which means that even the nature of the planets and the formation of the planets and so forth. So we discuss a lot of these subjects in the hope and with the objective to influence the TOVP projects. For the Temple of the Vedic Planetarium in Mayapur. Many of you already know, of course, a fantastic, great new building there. And there's the main dome, of course, where there is the Panchatattva and all the main deities that go in, of course. Huge, huge thing, larger than St. Paul's Cathedral, huge, huge dome. And then, of course, there's the west dome and the, well, west wing and the right wing, sorry, the east wing and the west wing. Relative, of course, to the main dome. And they're smaller domes, but still very large. And the one on the west wing, I believe, is where the Nrisimha will be installed. And the other side, of course, is the will be the Vedic Planetarium or exhibition. So the idea is that people will be taking darshan of the they'll be as described by Prabhupada. People will be looking up and they'll actually see a depiction or a model and of the universe and beyond Bhumandala and these various locals. But actually there's going to be a miniature version of that in the East Wing dome, where which is dedicated to exhibitions of this nature, as I mentioned, where there'll perhaps be and then within that and also within that same dome there'll be, I guess you describe it, or the plan, or the thoughts are, the plans are, from what I hear, is like a museum of thought revolving around Vedic cosmology. But also the works of, for example, Jhutakarma for Buddha, for example, forbidden archaeology as well. So that his work is more there. But also you have, for example, the work of many, many scholars and devoted thinking, let's say, devoted who are into this stuff, will also be represented in some way. That's what it's hoped. For example, Saddhaputta Bhikkhu, the late Saddhaputta Bhikkhu, who's done a lot of work for the Backchanter Institute in regard to this subject. His book, Mysteries of the Sacred Universe, or Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. There's a lot of fantastic articles he's written. As well, that appeared in Back to Godhead magazines on, and that touch, a lot of it is on Vedic cosmology as well. So, of course, the idea is that I think that there's so much of this stuff, there's even a lot of history of thought, including in the Madhva Sampradaya, other Sampradayas, but also the Gaudiya Sampradaya as well, who have, let's say, have resources, views, and depictions and illustrations on the Bhagavatam cosmology. I'm trying to understand the Bhumandala as well, which is like a, described as a flat disk in space, about 4 billion miles across, and as a feature in the universe. And above it, of course, is the seven higher lokas, and below it is the seven lower lokas. So what I'm going to do in the remaining few minutes of my class, and I know there's probably going to be a few questions as well, I just wanted to describe a little bit about the lower ones. Because, of course, the higher ones, the higher lokas, the higher planetary levels or systems, Satchaloka, of course, you both are Lord Brahma. Then, of course, you've got Tapaloka, Jnanaloka. You're going down the gradation. Mahaloka. Then you also have Indraloka, Dhruvaloka, and then Bhuloka, Sarvabhauloka, Earth-like planets, where, you know, advanced humanoid beings like could reside, Siddhas, Gandharvas. Bhuloka, which is the Earth level, but Bhugola specifically, the Earth globe on which we reside. But underneath these planets, of course, you've got Dilgaswam, heavenly, subterranean heavenly planet, whose populations are underground, it's subterranean realms. Atala, I won't go into the details right now, but just as a general overview, Atala, Vitala, Talatala, Mahatala, Sutala, Patala, Rasatala, so these different realms as well in the universe, which are, many of them, their standard of living, material living, is much higher than we experience on the earth, but they're described as lower because spiritually they're lower. Their consciousness is lower. And it was, they're enjoying so much with their own, perhaps, science or their own achievements, their own standard of living is so much greater than what we can barely imagine, actually, on the earth. That when it comes to spiritual life, when it comes to worship, when it comes to anything like that, austerities and some of these things, fasting, these activities, which I guess are dharma, they are absent in the lower worlds. Thus, they're described as lower. Of course, by the time you do get to Rasatala or Patala, things start getting quite dark, where they would become unattractive to us. Where, you know, people live in holes like snakes, as described with the Nagaloka, particularly people who are snake-like beings, let's say, who can even change shape, and they're living in dark places where there's no sunlight reaches. So everything has to be artificially lit. So that's basically some of the characteristics there of the lower planets. So again, this gradations, as I've been talking about in the material world, material universe, is not necessarily to do with standard of living or how heavenly it might be. It's actually more to do with gradations of piety and consciousness, like that. The earth is described as being in the middle region, the middle category, because we have, let's say, a mixture of heaven and hell, in a sense, on the earth. We have impiety, but we also have piety. We have extreme suffering, but we also have enjoyment here. Whereas in some planets, very low in the material universe, described as Naraka planets or hellish planets, there's only suffering. You know, their karma, I guess, is taking them in that direction, unfortunately. Not eternal. Nothing's eternal in this material world. But for, I guess, a long time, they would suffer in hell before returning to the earth. Because they deserved it, basically. All their karma, what they deserved and what they desired, took them to that planet. So, of course, but the earth has hellish aspects itself. But it also has more heavenly aspects. It's just that when you visit these lokas, as I say, it's, you get those characteristics, but in more fullness. The whole planet is beautiful, for example. The whole planet is beautiful. No problems, no diseases, heavenly ones, no stress. And in the lower, and in the hellish planets, everything is the opposite. Everything is just terrible. But of course, as Prabhupada writes in his purport, devotees are not even aiming to enter any of those planets. We are aiming to the eternal world, the spiritual world, which is higher and above all of these things. So that's the character, because even the demigods, even Lord Brahma, as long as they live, still their life is temporary. 311 odd trillion earth years, but the length of Lord Brahma sounds like a long time, but to him it only feels like, I don't know, 100 years maximum. Only feels like that to him. So he also has to die. Lord Brahma also has to die. All the demigods also have to perish. And to them it just feels like a lifetime, a normal, so-called normal lifetime to them. So there's that fear, that where am I going to take birth next? So we don't want to keep taking birth in the material world. We want to enter the spiritual world, where one doesn't have to take birth again, where one can attain one's spiritual form and live forever in bliss and happiness. So I'll stop there, Prabhus, but I'm now going to put my headphones on, so it'll be easier for me to hear any questions. So just bear with me a second. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much for your beautiful class. We heard very nice things. Very beautiful reading about the ecstatic symptoms of bhakti and the external manifestations of those who have attained pure love of God. It was very, very beautiful and inspiring to see the exchanges between the divine couple in the spiritual world, and in this way help us understand what are the dynamics of spiritual life. As well, you spoke in this last part, you spoke a lot about the journey to Goloka Vrindavan and how the advanced devotees do not desire even for heavenly pleasure or to merge into the Brahmajyoti. This raised a few questions. And the first question we have is from Prayajan Prabhu in the temple room, and is asking, what is the position of Satyaloka, where the great sages exist? Because they come down to the earthly planets to spread Krishna consciousness.
So, well, that sounds like, I'm not sure, that sounds like a rhetorical question in a sense. So what is the position of the great sages that come from the higher planets to preach on the earth? So that's what they do. It's true, sometimes you do find that great personalities from Satyaloka, or sometimes there's a lot of great sages also in Janaloka and Tapaloka, the destination of people who've performed tapas, austerity. Janaloka, those that have performed great feats of celibacy and things like that, in great brahmacharis and sannyas. Some of them may take birth there. But of course, they're still in the material world, but it does seem that, yes, great souls do voluntarily, I suppose, come to the earth to preach. That's possible to do that. In fact, it's described that people on the heavenly planets can even voluntarily come to the earth simply to take birth in Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to take part in Mahaprabhu's movement.
Yes.
So that's the position of them. Now, Prayojana's question, I think, is probably, when he says, what is their position, he might be asking, well, are they, how elevated are they? Because they're still not coming from the spiritual world. They're coming from the heavenly planets to preach. And there's even an interesting quote by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, which I've heard about, where he once looked at the moon, Bhaktisiddhanta, and said, oh, I have to go there and preach because there's too much sense of gratification on the moon. So it does seem that there are some personalities, Narad Muni perhaps being the best example, and we've been speaking a lot about Narad Muni today, that they are so advanced they could voluntarily travel around the spiritual and the material worlds and preach, if you like, and take part in pastimes. So the sages that Virginia Prabhu is talking about appear to be more in that category, as far as I know. There may, of course, be some sages that may not be qualified in some way to go to the spiritual world, or choose not to go, perhaps. You know, they're not quite in Narad Muni's category, perhaps, but still they come and they preach Dharma, preach, you know, good principles and Dharma principles on the earth. That's also quite possible. Like we said, it's Mahaprabhu that can take us to Goloka Vrindavan, and Vaishnavism and so forth that can get us into advanced levels, as it were, of course, to Vaikuntha. But, you know, demigod worship, for example, if you worship the demigods, you go to the planets of the demigods. But that's still a promotion, actually. It's better than living an Adamic life or a life of sin. So there are even beings that come from the heavenly planets and whose objectives is to help humankind. But it's according to perhaps their own traditions and their own mentality like that. I think that helps, doesn't it?
Yes, it gives some light on the question. Yeah. The second question that came is about the stages of purification. Because when we hear the exchanges between the divine couple, some understanding or some samskars come in the heart. And by this imprint, this spiritual imprint in the heart, we become to construct a relationship with the spiritual, with the eternal. But it seems there is a transaction stage, there is a boundary which is crossed. As we are hearing Katha, Krishna Katha, our heart becomes imprinted with samskars. But then there is a stage that comes after, there's a boundary, there's something that transforms. What is it, and what happens as these samskars are being built?
Are you talking about the, okay, I'm not actually sure of the question here. Are you talking about like the in-between stages? Being in the material consciousness and spiritual consciousness.
Yeah.
Right. That's an interesting question, because I imagine that's relevant for all devotees, because you could say that we are all on the path, albeit in my own personal case, the very beginning part, stage of that path, where one is not, obviously very few of us are on that level as described in the Nectar of Devotion and so forth. We're not quite on that level, or the Gopi level, or the Narad Muni level. So what you're saying is, what happens before we get there, right? What are there any symptoms we can exhibit before we... And the only thing I can say to that is this, because I you know, it's a kind of a difficult question for me to grasp. But there are characteristics of great devotees. We read in the Gita, don't we, that Arjuna asks Krishna, how does one, if one is, you know, a great devotee, how does one sit? How does one eat? How does one behave? What are the characteristics? And that's something that we can explore, because I don't think that, you know, some of the extent, like the, you know, the hair standing on end and so on and so forth, is something which is going to be experienced. We're going to see too much of that because we're in the Kali Yuga. However, you know, you do see devotees, how they sometimes they can be fixed up, how they can be blissful. We have to understand that if someone's happy, but also, not only that, but here's something else I want to talk about. It's about culture, it's about values. Because before we become superhuman, we have to become human. We cannot go to superhumanhood without being a human, if we are previously an animal, or almost like an animal. You know, what does it mean to be human? Means polite, humble, forgiving, patient, pleasant, you know, for the most part. We have to look at how we behave as people, and then we can start thinking about being superhuman. But so once we've got those attributes, these high values, the mode of goodness, basically, we can think about transcendental goodness, transcendence. And, you know, crying in kirtan, for example, not just doing it superficially, but really relishing the holy names, And occasionally you do, this is experienced actually in ISKCON, especially in Kirtan. I remember once when it was actually a Prabhupada Vyasa Puja day, and someone was talking about their remembrances of Prabhupada, for example. And I can't remember the details, it's not necessary to know them. But this Prabhupada disciple was reading something and she began to cry. Not out of sadness, but out of happiness. It wasn't a mundane thing. Another devotee started to cry as well. And this was not out of misery, this was something else. I felt this was something very special. In fact, there's many examples of people who took darshan of Srila Prabhupada who would describe these kind of things. Even Prabhupada himself would exhibit. So there was once when I think Prabhupada was giving class and he stopped and then he started to cry. I mean, tears were coming down his eyes. And so, Prabhupada, are you okay? One of his senior disciples said, Srila Prabhupada, are you all right? And he said, I am so grateful for you. You know, you see, he was so grateful that he could serve his Guru Maharaj. So. Makes me cry now, actually. So this is not mundane, this is special. Anyway, that's my realizations on yes. that question. I hope that helps.
Okay. Thank you for your help. There's one last question from Harika Mataji in the temple. She asks for help to understand this ecstatic love for Krishna, because we need to be in a spiritual world to experience, or can we sometimes have glimpses of it in our mundane life?
Very good question.
There's a second part to it, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Does the love we feel for human beings, is it actual love, or is that just lust? That lust and only love for Krishna can be real.
Okay, I think I understand those two questions. Okay, I'll answer them quite quickly because okay. I can see that we need to finish class. Okay, it's got written here in the chat. All right. Okay, I'll be very, very quick. Let's start off with the slightly more accessible one for us. There's different types of love. I think the word in Sanskrit, there's 8 different words which would translate as love into English. So for us, the English language, you have love, love of parents, love of neighbours, love of spouse, love of children, and then love of God. In one sense, we're unfortunate because we live in a society where there's not much love, because we only have the word love, one love, for all of that. In Sanskrit, you've got different words for different types of love. So the love of a dog, for example, or love of your pet, isn't the same as a love of Krishna. Again, we get into these gradations. However, there's nothing wrong with saying you love your dog, or you love your wife, or you love your husband, or you love your children. There is some, because what it is, it's a glimpse of love of Krishna. It's inferior, I would say, but still it's showing great attachment and affection for that. So I think that kind of addresses that question, yeah. doesn't it? Yeah. The other question was about, we actually know from the Lila itself, for example, between Mahaprabhu and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, in fact, many, many people who were with Mahaprabhu, who experience in this world, in these bodies, actually experience these type of spiritual realizations. Mahaprabhu himself said, I'm in the spiritual world. Because as I said, the main theme of the class was that the spiritual world is not necessarily a physical place that you enter. Yeah. It is a state of consciousness.
Yes.
And the answer to it is yes, you can be in the spiritual world and still have this body. But it's probably quite rare and special to do that. And the symptoms of that would be some of these ecstatic symptoms that we were reading about today. It is possible we can get glimpses of these things. We can get a drop of that ocean. The spiritual world, of course, being the ocean, the mercy of Mahaprabhu being that ocean. And from time to time, we may get a little droplet of water of that. And it keeps us going. It keeps us going in our spiritual life. Sometimes we get that little bit here and there. And we have to try. The more we try, the more the results we get. And eventually we'll be drinking from the ocean. I hope that helps. I think that's probably the best I can do in the time frame we have. Do you think that's okay?
All right, yeah. We'll end up our Chaitanya Charitamrita class here. Yes, everything's okay. Thank you, Prabhu, for your time, for your kind words and wise words.
Thank you.